T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Never sort of leaves you. I mean, you talk about the stress, which is part of it, or the psychological aspect, but in terms of, because you seem to be a main guy. I mean, if they gave you this main message that is now sort of unraveling, you can see that the government, like Kit Green, comes back to you like 30 years later, and he's talking to you, which he seems to know you're important, and whether the phenomena has sort of followed you, because people will talk about having not major experiences, but whether they seem to be part of something bigger than themselves.
I'm definitely think that's the case with the code, for sure.
Yeah.
But no, I don't have, I haven't had no recurring contact or anything like that. But I, some of these dreams are pretty graphic. I mean, so they're manageable, but to say that I'm having contact with someone or something like that.
Because one of the stories I'd heard, and it may have come through Burroughs or somebody, was this thing where they were using guys like you to bait the thing. That to bring it in, whether you could bring this thing in, because it's the old idea, they can't bring it in. So, I mean, they would look at you or somebody who's had contact and say, can you bring it in for us so we can interact with it or whatever they want to do with it?
Well, that'd be pure fantasy if we said that. That's a fantasy thought, because I know nothing that, first of all, the technology with this craft is nothing that we can even replicate today. So, no, it's the blind leading the blind. As far as, and we talked about it, there's so much disinformation going out there that, you know, the government's really good at this stuff. I mean, most of, I would say 99.9% from the Pentagon is all a false flag operation. That's all false flag. With the Navy and all that other stuff, false flag operation. With ATIP, that's false flag. The hearings in Washington, I'm going to tell you what, and you know this too, Grant, there's nothing that you're going to find out any new stuff that's unclassified. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. We're doing like testimony in Congress. Believe me, it's just general mumble, false flag stuff, because the real core of the stuff is still classified, top secret or whatever, you know? So that's the stuff that's being, you know, the disinformation that's going on.
And do you think they've been able to unravel anything in terms of, like, when Kit Green comes and tells you about this thing about the brain, how much do you think they have unraveled, or do you think they're basically walking around in the dark?
Yeah. No, Green, they're looking at how do you do interdimensional travel? How do you do time travel? That's what they want, the goal. Can you imagine that? If that was discovered, oh my God, how powerful would you be?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that was what Green said. Whether it's true, I don't know, but that's what he said. And the whole 2 days with Green was shocking. Okay, I mean, I get with the attorney at night, we'd have like dinner or something like that. Like, wow, can you believe today? And he went, no, I don't believe today. I says, wow, where do we start? I mean, it was mind blowing. And but I could see if you're a weak person. You could probably get led into anything they were saying, you know, I guess.
You got him pretty frustrated at times. He was pretty upset with you that you weren't playing.
He got mad. He got so mad that the first day he got mad at me. When we were having lunch, we hadn't even started yet. And he says, I flew all the way in here from, I don't know, wherever, Detroit, I don't know where he's from. And And he says, now he says you don't want to answer. And I says, hey, I says, I drove 30 miles here. I said, I don't care. I'll leave. I don't give a shit. That's what I told him. I don't care. I said, we don't do the interview. Like I don't care. And he was like, then all of a sudden he calms down. Well, he says, we got to have some rules. I said, no rules. There's no rules. I'm not no kid. Don't give me no rules. I mean, I'll follow laws and stuff like that, but not from Kid Green. No rules.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose if you're a weak-minded person, you could get drugging and all that crap he was giving me. You know, I'm trying to keep it clean here.
And you were out by then. You were out of the military by then, right? When
that was. Let's see, when did it have that? I can't remember exactly. Gary, when was that? Was it 11?
October the well, when you retired. When you retired?
No, when I was talking to Green. When I was talking to Green, when was that exactly? You recall that date?
Yeah, it was in 2012, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
12, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it was pretty frustrating for him. But he kept coming back, though, and he wanted to, it turned out that he stopped asking me a lot of questions, and that's when it turned to he was telling me information. Whether it was all true, I do not know. But
yeah.
He was telling me his information rather than getting information from me.
It's funny, I just want to interject here again. A lot of my earlier research was what I later found out were Kit Green and Gary Nolan were working on, with the parts of the brain that, that you have this experience, which I call the hypnagogic state. I'd say it's the hypnagogic state. I think that's the open sesame to all paranormal mystical experiences, what Colin Wilson said. And that was my earlier research, and I you'll know that what's doing the rounds on the internet is this kind of superimposition of the Eye of Horus on the brain. That was my insight years ago.
Wow.
And then I realized, that's my insight. That's what I came up with. I was the first one to come up with that. And then people run with it and it's all over the internet and they don't know who the source of that is. But I've been on Magical Egypt series with Chance Gardner and they showcased that discovery of mine, or what I'd say my insight. And that came after my experience. But I was into all that research before I got involved in the code, about ancient Egypt and about the shamanism, those hypnagogic state experiences, because I had what I would consider an enlightened experience in 93. So that's why I was into all that. And I was really researching about my own experience or trying to find out more about it.
Can we talk to you about your experience? Talk about that experience. I think we asked you about that before. It was kind of a weird.
Yeah. Because I'm just a normal guy from Peckham, Southeast London, a working class guy. I went to, normal, ordinary school. Although it was quite, how can I put it? The school I went to was a grammar school anyway. But I left before I took any exams or anything. I went straight into working with my dad on, screen printing and that. So it's funny because the environment I grew up in is not conducive to the kind of experience I had, and what I later found out was because of what I experienced, what the symptoms of the experience I experienced was to do with Kundalini awakening. Yeah.
Okay.
But I was totally ignorant about all that before. And I had no prior instruction or knowledge of that whatsoever. It just happened spontaneously to me. And it was because I was messing around with a hypnagogic state, trying to stay awake at the point where you fall asleep, so you're awake and asleep at the same time. And I think that is the state of consciousness you're in when you have all these paranormal mystical experiences. And that would be what Jenny Randalls calls the Oz factor, So, and I think that's what's conducive to a lot of these experiences. So I was into all that research about that. And that's how I got in touch with Chance Gardner, who does the Magical Egypt series, because I was finding things in the symbolism of ancient Egypt, which kind of pointed to that experience, And then there was the connection with the Hindu Vedas, and their diagrams and iconography of the Kundalini. And I'm sure that kind of related, I think, Egypt Egypt had their own symbolism associated with that scene. That's what I was doing. I was working on that. So, yeah, all the stuff that I kind of realized later on that what Kit Green was into and Gary Nolan, what they were looking at, these sections of the brain to do with the thalamus, the optic thalamus in the brain, which is what I would consider to be the third eye, the real third eye, because there's like three kind of components of the third eye, the pineal gland, the pituitary, and the thalamus in the center. And I was writing about that. And that's what in one of the first books I wrote, or the two first books I wrote, which was the Serpent Grail and the Shining Ones. And even Ancient Aliens took that about the thalamus, and they used what I'd written word for word in my book, but never credited me with it, about the thalamus on an Ancient Aliens episode. So I thought, yeah, I'm just not getting a recognition here. You know, it's like it's, all these people are taking my work and things I found out I was working on 20 years ago. So, I was into all that before I found out that Kit Green and Gary Nolan. And who else was it? Was it
Colin Kelleher and they were all on that team, yeah.
And of course, you know, I was already involved with Jack Safari from 1999 and the people he was involved with, Al Puthoff and that. And Colin Wilson was one of my friends. So, yeah, I mean, I was working on all that before and I understood the processes. So it's strange now that they got involved with Jim, you know, and they were working on this stuff because it kind of all connected together. And I think that what I was working on at the time was all in preparation for me working on the code. But what I want to really say, and I need to emphasize this point, is that the code is mathematical and you can't get any more objective than mathematics. You know, it goes beyond all our subjective beliefs, opinions, views. You know, we can be talking about all these UFO cases, but there's no real proof. But with this code, there is mathematical proof that it predicts a 12-digit number that came up 38 years later. And there's no way anyone could have known that or predicted it. And to me, that is proof of contact. It's proof of some intelligence that was able to devise this code to show us that it was actually a demonstration of retrocausality. You know, the information was being sent back to the past that has an effect on the present, which was at that time in 2018, and probably has an effect on the future.
So that's the bottom line. What do you think the bottom line of the code? Where's this all headed? If you're going to look, say, in terms of what's important about this for humanity, what's this all about?
I think the exploration of humanity is all these sites, the coordinate sites. And you see the fine structure constant number, the 12-digit fine structure constant number, that was only the way it authenticates itself. I don't know whether there's any further significance of that, but it could be because of the phi ratio, because the pyramids are positioned at Giza to the phi ratio, and this golden cut latitude divides the distance between the two pyramids, two furthest pyramids, into the phi proportions of 1 and 0.618, then that golden cut latitude and the numbers in that golden cut latitude is what, you know, generates the fine structure constant number, 12 digits. Because the fine structure constant is embedded in the phi ratio, that there might be, and this is something I was working with Jimmy Blanchett on, there might be a relationship between the fine structure constant, the nuclear fine structure constant, and the phi ratio. And it's got something to do with vortex physics, something to do with the vortex. Because they're now finding out that the fine structure constant is a ratio between the nucleus of a subatomic particle and the surface. But it's all with a vortex, you see. But the center of a subatomic particle at zero is the vanishing point of the phi ratio spiral, you know, like a golden spiral. So it's all related to vortex physics. And I'm thinking that there might be some kind of connection with time, with breaking the time barrier there. And it's all kind of encoded at Giza.
Yeah, Gary, what about that the code, it could only, you have to use a code from 1980 or else none of this works.
Yeah. And that's another thing, Grant, I wanted to say that, and I think we did talk about this before when we were when I was in an interview with you before, 1980 is the only year in the whole timeline of history, 1980 was the only year that this demonstration of retrocausality with this prediction of the 12-digit number could only have been implemented, only in 1980, because if you take the numbers in the Golden Cut Latitude in 1979, it wouldn't produce the same 12-digit number. If you took the Golden Cut Latitude numbers in 1981, it still wouldn't produce the same 12-digit number. So 1980 was the only year that this demonstration of retrocausality could be implemented. And that's the reason why I think the Rendlesham incident happened in 1980. And the funny thing is, it happened on Boxing Day and around Christmas time, as if it was a Christmas gift to mankind, you know, to humanity. So, yeah.
This thing would not have unraveled unless it had been you coming in. Is almost, that's where the connection between you and Jim is, that you're part of the story as well to unravel this thing. When I listen to these lectures that Jimmy Blanchette does, when you're finished, your mouth is hanging open. You just can't believe how exact this is. And yet you need someone like you and like Jimmy and like the Jim to get the code to unravel this. And people think they're going to land on the White House lawn and tell us stuff from some planet. And you start to realize it's this very complex thing where they make you go through 500 hoops and mathematics. And then you figure it out for yourself and you go, oh, and it's basically telling you how reality actually works. But they're not telling you through a lecture. They're making you figure it out.
You hit the nail on the head. The only way anything's going to be proven is through mathematics, because you can't refute it. You cannot pull apart the fact that 2 + 2 = 4. You can't pull that apart. It's a fact. So when something is proven with mathematics, you've got to accept it. And I think that the code is way it's telling us that there is a phenomenon. We know there's a phenomenon, but this code actually proves it through mathematics, that there was a message that was, it was contact. And also Carl Sagan said, what would make us sit up and take notice is if the fine structure constant was part of a message that was sent from an high intelligence or extraterrestrial intelligence. If the fine structure constant was in the message somehow, then that would be worthy of considerable attention. That's what he said in a book in 1982, I think.
And if you look at his movie Contact, it's almost what you guys have done. Is the contact is they get this sort of a mathematical thing that they got to put the puzzle together, and they're sitting there, and it's this very complex puzzle. So I'm almost like, you think, did Sagan know about this? Did he have an insight? Because it's almost your story. Watch the movie Contact, this is what's going on here.
But there's another thing. Grant, there's another thing that we're missing here, and this is something else is important. There was a movie called UFO with Gillian Anderson and David Strathairn. Remember that in 19? And it was actually in 2018. It came out in 2018, which was when the fine structure constant number was predicted by the code, in 2018. And the UFO movie, it features a binary code message that has the fine structure constant in it.
That's where you got to wonder what's going on.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah, also, Grant, now I think that there's, you don't need to have your DNA checked and you don't need all this other stuff. But there is actual contact, because if they want to have contact, you're going to have contact. If you don't, they're in control on this. And so even going back to you in 2012, when you had this awakening of this contact, and that's what I'll call it. You were having communication at that point. There are people, I think, all over the world. I think the ideal situation, if we could have all those people in the same room, just put them all in the same room, and then we can talk, because I think there's pieces being done,
Yeah, because there's other things, when I saw the DNA, I don't know if you know the story of Tim Taylor, who is the guy in American Cosmic. He's the guy at NASA who he said that DNA is the antenna. that's how communication is taking place with DNA. And there are actually antennas that are shaped like DNA molecules that are for deep space transmission and stuff like that. And then you start to going like, wow, maybe these guys know something. That's why when I heard they went after the DNA, it may not be, well, like, why do you need someone's DNA? And it may be that it's all programmed in the DNA, and the DNA is not what we think it is. Wow. It's much more complex than we think.
I accept that, Grant. Yeah, that's actually what I was talking about. When I was talking about the brain and the antenna, they're calling it the antenna. Yep. You know, that's why I was able to.
Yeah, in fact, Mark, you're on here. You can jump in. He told you that. Mark Olson, are you still here? What did Tim Taylor tell you about hair and about the DNA, about in terms of contact? And the deep space thing, when they did the implants, it was the 150, whatever the frequency was. And it's the same as the deep space transmissions. But Mark, are you here?
Yeah, I am. I'm right here.
Okay, tell us what Tim said about the DNA.
Tim said NASA designed all their antennas in replica of DNA. Yeah. So and if you'll think about these super spiral antennas, if you've seen them before, when he said it, it made all kinds of sense. And then you think, if our DNA is a receptor or an antenna, obviously maybe that's how our intuition works. That's how our interconnectivity works. Telepathy through thought, through energy, which is what we are. So Tim was very interesting. And that was, I remember Grant, you and I having that discussion with him, and he definitely was on that track of DNA being an antenna.
As well, right? He told you about hair being an antenna.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you wonder, like, where is he getting this from? Because he's, you know, he's sort of like an insider. And then when I hear they're going after the DNA, I go like, is it connected to what Tim Taylor was talking about? And that's why I always wonder, like, what do these guys know? Do they have some insight as to what's going on? I'm sure, yeah, like, I agree with you, Jim, that there's no way anybody, this is never going to be discussed publicly. It's all classified, top secret. And as Eric Walker, the guy at Penn State University, told us, he said, you're just curious, admit it. He said, we're never going to tell you. Why would we change the rules? Why would you change the regulations and rules to satisfy your curiosity? Answer that for me. They're never going. There's no way. I mean, they're into the space travel and weapons and whatever they're going to get out. It's just curiosity. That's all we want to know is, like, what's really going on. Yeah. And they could care less what we think about it.
Well, I agree. Agree.
Yeah. So that
I want to just. Yeah, I want to say something else. You know, when I was talking about the superimposition of the Eye of Horus, the ancient Egyptian Eye of Horus symbolism on the brain, I was actually vindicated in my research on that, because, or my insight into it, because five neuroscientists or neuro doctors, surgeons from, was it John Hopkins University? They wrote a paper saying that the Eye of Horus symbolism, the ancient Eye of Horus symbolism, does certain sections of the Eye of Horus symbolism, they coincide with certain parts of the brain, the thalamus, the pituitary gland, the pineal, corpus callosum of the brain. And it was a paper written by these five neurosurgeons, okay? And that was in, I think it was 2015. But I had actually come to the insight of that back in 2001. So what I'm saying is, it's kind of vindication if they actually think this as merit, that this superimposition of the Eye of Horus symbolism with the brain as merit, you know. And this is something that Chance Gardner and I would kind of really, you know.
Let me ask one more question, and then we can maybe go to questions, because a lot of people are asking questions. In terms of, would you agree with me that the intelligence, what they're doing is it's coming from the bottom up? So they're saying, okay, try to stop this. And so Jim gets the message, you start to decode this thing, it starts to go around, people start talking about it. And there's nothing the government can really do to stop it. That's the disclosure. It's coming from the bottom up rather than from the government down.
Right. Yeah, this is what's going on right now. I think this is all part of the disclosure, really, that because this code is giving us truths through mathematics, it's proving that there was some kind of contact and there was something, you know, that extraordinary happened at Rendlesham. And it's proving it through mathematics. I mean, you really have to look into what I've been working on. Jimmy Blanchett has been working on it as well. It's all mathematical, and you cannot refute the mathematics of it. So that, as I see it, is where the truth lies. It's something that's going to come out. The more people know about it, there'll be a tipping point where, you know, a lot of people know about it and accept it.
So Jimmy Blanchette's making his stuff public. When's your next book? Because I'm kind of excited to find out, you know, as you unravel this stuff, that, because that's what we need to do, is sort of get it out there where people talk about it and comment on it. And so when's the next disclosure thing that you guys are going to put out in terms of what you've discovered?
Well, the second book, which deals with the initial information that I was able to decipher from the seven coordinates, that's going to come out this year. I wanted to put the third book out at the same time, but then Jim and I discussed it, best if the third book comes out later, because people need to digest this stuff, you know, bit by bit. So, and the third book will mostly be about the Giza plateau and what that's given us in terms of the unveiling of the things that have been encoded there by whatever intelligence it was that built the Giza, you know, pyramid field. Because we still don't know, really. We still don't know. You know, we accept it that the ancient Egyptians built Giza, but what's coming out of it, what I've discovered through the code and what it's giving us, is that this seems to have been, I mean, the mathematical properties of the pyramids themselves and the distances that are in, you know, like multiples of pi and, you know, phi, and it seems that this has been devised by an advanced intelligence, perhaps the same intelligence that's given us the code. You know,
and they sort of planned it that it would take 5,000 years to unravel, that this was all put in the code was all put in 5,000 years ago or 10 or whenever they built all this stuff. And then when you see your work and you see Jimmy Blanchette's work, you realize, like, oh, this is connected to this and this is connected to this, and we're just discovering it now, and it's been there for 5,000 or 10,000 years.
Yeah, it's like the monolith in 2001, you know, the Great Pyramids, like that monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know.
Yeah.
it's like part of our evolution as we're getting closer to the secrets that it holds, you know, or contains, you know.
Yeah. When you see the exactness of the mathematics, where, you know, Jimmy's got like 99.95% accurate, you know, and stuff like that, and you're going like, wow, it's just like, and it's just unraveling. So I appreciate the work you've done. Mitzi, let's go to questions. Have you got some people that have some questions? I know one asked about the dreams. Somebody wanted to know if you give a little more detail about the dreams that you have.
Well,
are they regular dreams? Are we talking like all the time, or is it just sort of?
One of the things is I never do an interview or anything like that in December. I don't do anything in January either. I try to avoid that stuff because it just like brings it all back.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it could be very mundane stuff. I mean, it could be like what I was doing that night, you know, in the course of, you know, my memory, what was going on. But then there's, you know, one of the things that I experienced out there that night in that sphere of influence was I had this range of emotions. I do describe it in a book, but it doesn't describe it as good as I wanted to, because it was just all over the place. It went from awe to fear to every emotion you could possibly have. It was just flying all over the place. And then sometimes those really terrifying thoughts and moments will come, you know, while I'm sleeping, you know, and I'll bring those. The other thing is I get new dreams and they sort of just dovetail off the what happened. You know, I don't know if you're just, you know, if it's just fantasy or, you know, how dreams are. I don't know. I was trying to think, the last time I woke up in bed, sitting up, sweating, was probably around New Year's. That was the last time. Did I dream about this a couple of days ago? Yeah. It just materializes every once in a while. And I am on medication that will help me. It's an alpha blocker or a beta blocker, I'm not sure. It'll block dreaming or make it softer so you don't get those nightmares from that. And I mean, it is part of the PTSD, I guess, with the situation.
Okay, there's a question here about aliens, and I don't think at any point aliens has come up in terms of what you think this is. You didn't, there was nothing on that. It's
Not in 43 years. Not in 43 years it hasn't.
So and let me ask this question. I mean, you've gone through this situation where you've gone for regression and medication and stuff like that. A lot of people, this started as an experiencer group where people came through. And one of the questions they want to ask at Ohio is how do you deal with people who have the PTSD in terms of this? So what kind of advice can you give people who are in the situation you were in 1980 in terms of what can help and what you can do?
Seek professional help. I mean, professional, don't go with these UFO people that go on these lecture circuits and they want to hypnotize you. They're suggestive anyway. They're going to do nothing but run. That's what you need to do. Run from them, because those people are doing you absolutely no good at all. They can put information in your head and that. So stay away from those quacks. They're quacks. Okay. They're not, if they go in, like my doctor and my psychiatrist at the time, they had nothing to do with UFOs. That wasn't, and I didn't even go in there for that. I went in there for a sleep disorder, which is totally different. I would suggest maybe the back door is better. Maybe have people go in and say you're having a sleep disorder, maybe, and go from there. But stick with professionals. I'm talking about medical doctors and psychiatrists and that, people that actually went to school for it. Okay, don't be doing these quacks that, UFO events or something, they want to do something or have a podcast, or stay away from those people.
Do they advise you to record your dreams? Do you record your dreams or write them down?
Oh, when I was seeing the psychiatrist, and I had to keep a log. Yeah, I kept a log, and I even went as far as, I had a voice activated one, because sometimes I talk my sleep, so I had a voice activated tape recorder. I used that, but for most part, that was I couldn't really get any information out of it, but they told me to take notes, and I did do that for that. I don't do it now. I mean, it's pointless, I think, to take notes. I don't know. I mean, at this point, I don't know.
But you've been a note taker in terms of all your whole life.
I am a note taker.
Would you do it again? Would you go through this again?
No, absolutely not. No way. No way. No way in this God's green earth I would go through this again. No way. No.
Wow.
You know what? I spent about 10 seconds deciding whether I was going to work the Christmas schedule, they asked me, or the New Year schedule. And I said, I'll work the Christmas schedule. I took 10 seconds on that decision. It's probably the worst decision I probably ever made in my life.
Wow.
I do think, though, and I'm not special. I'm just another guy that was working. But I think I handled it differently than most people involved with this type of phenomena. They are easily led, and they love their 15 minutes of fame and all that kind of stuff. And they're, let's face it, after the incident, I never even talked about it for the remainder of time in the Air Force. I was on orders, but I didn't talk about it. And even my family didn't know, my family back home, or they didn't know nothing about it except for that stupid unsolved mystery show that came out. Otherwise, they wouldn't have known. So I kept quiet for another 11 years after that. Yes, I think it was a form of artificial intelligence. Because I know one thing, the craft wasn't manned. Okay. Hey, Professor Paul's on there, huh? Okay. You know what I'm doing? I'm reading the notes.
Yes, good. Okay, good.
Okay. I'm sorry, I lost.
You've seen the same thing I've seen, yeah.
But Professor Paul was on this. Oh, I hadn't talked to him for a while. So better give him, send him an email or something,
Jim, can I just interject? Jim, can I just interject here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because John Burroughs has always said that you got your account from your hypnosis. Yeah. But your hypnosis sessions took place in 1994. And right. You actually was in an interview with Sally Rao in 93 when you was talking all about your experience with the craft and it and all of it that is actually in the book, you know, most of it.
Well, and also in November of 93, after I got out, I think it was, I was working with the Stewart and Associates. I was the vice president too, it was a nice job. And I spoke at the Pilots Association. I think that was actually the first time I talked.
Well, it was 18 days after you retired, wasn't it? Because you retired on October the 31st, 1993. And then you did
it
that
was.
18 days later. And yeah, because I remember all the dates. But what I want to say is, you know, John Burroughs saying that all he saw was lights and he said that he never saw you walk around the craft. But you sent out a helping and an urgent message, helping and message, you remember?
Right, exactly.
Because, you know, there was talk about the helping hands. Well, just describe what a helping hand is.
A helping hand is a telephonic, by radio, up-channel report that goes to the Central Security Control, to the Wing Command Post in this order, to numbered Air Force, and then it goes to MAGCOM, Major Air Command, and then, you know, it's serious enough, it might get thrown up to the Pentagon, you know. And so that's what I initiated that because there was a threat. That was the only, it wasn't aircraft downing. So it was a possible threat because I didn't know what that was. So, it shouldn't be there, okay? I knew that much. And so that's why the helping hand situation went up. And why don't you explain a little bit about how that helping hand was known at the Pentagon?
Yeah, it's an exclusive.
In Europe.
Yeah, it's an exclusive for you, Grant. And I don't know whether you know about this because we have mentioned it in other interviews. Well, only one interview we mentioned it. After the book came out, Tech Sergeant Mark Cartier got in touch with Jim and he said, I was at Hellenikon Air Base in Greece at that time. And it was on the 26th of December, 1980, that it came over like an urgent kind of message came over that just like left everyone in awe. And then saying that there was a UFO, a bogey that was sighted over Rendlesham Forest, at Bentwaters Base. And this must have been initiated by Jim's helping hand report.
It was.
And did you know that what is significant about this is that it went from DEFCON 4 to DEFCON 2? Is that right, Jim?
Yeah, certain places in Europe went to DEFCON 2.
Yeah.
That's according to Mark Cartier.
Just one away from total war. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, that's not been known before because James Cartier came forward after the book came out and said, yeah, I experienced that. And he wrote a statement.
Yeah, he worked, just to give you a little background on him, he worked at a central comms center for Europe, U.S. Air Force's Europe, in Greece. And, you know, he has the top secret clearance. He did all that stuff. And this was a flash override or a drop rev jiffy or one of those down channel alerting orders that would cause that. And I mean, there was a lot of commotion going on in that communication center at that time. And they recruited in his boss and they even checked with their commander. I mean, they got this information out right away. But to initiate a DEFCON chain of any kind is like huge. I mean, it's big. So, that's some of the things that's happened with the Rendlesham and Ingram book. We do get credible people from different areas that were working. Right now, we know for a fact that Rendlesham was known at the time and at the Pentagon in the United States, on that continent, you know, the United States. It was known in Greece, and then it was sent out as a down-channel report to different bases within Europe. I mean, of the situation, I mean, through a DEFCON change. And so it's not just England. I mean, we're talking, you know, Europe, and then we're talking the United States. So there's a lot of people in the know at the time. It wasn't just like, oh, they're just investigating the aircraft down. There's more to it than that. More.
And all that was because of your encounter, Jim. It went to DEFCON 2 because of the encounter you had and the helping hand report you sent out.
Yeah, but the helping hand also helped me out there because it kept me focused. I was to run my checklist because I was pretty panicked out there. I tell you what, one of the things is prior to going to Bentwaters and Woodbridge, back in 74, 75, I had an assignment at SAC headquarters. I worked the underground. I worked for the SAC elite guard, got my security clearance, top secret there. We were bodyguards for 31 generals. There was 5 levels of the underground. We would do security for research and development meetings from NATO and everything else there. And, you know, you can get to watch that stuff, you know, because you're doing security. And I'll tell you right now, there was nothing that they were forecasting 50 years in the future from 1974, nothing that could be replicated with the Remnants from Forest incident as far as that craft. Nothing. I mean, they did have triangular craft forecasts. I mean, aircraft, but they didn't look like what happened there. They didn't have the technology with light. They didn't have technology with streaming of light that held things up, carry weight. The other thing, the craft itself, it didn't have like a sonic boom. We should have had a sonic boom, I think, took off. There's no air displacement, none of that stuff. I mean, all stuff that you got to have with aircraft even today. So there's that wasn't there. And I think that's part of knowing that stuff. That was part of the stuff where I was pretty freaked out because I went, this is not ours. And it sure wasn't the Russians. They were dumbing a box of rocks at the time. They stole technology. And the Chinese, that was way beyond anything they could do. So, it's just like, wow, this is not ours. It's somebody's, but it's not ours. And that's why I give it, it didn't have a nomenclature on it. So I said, it's a craft of unknown origin. And I'll tell you what, I never lied about it. I mean, that's the most, that was the best way I knew how to say what it was without using trigger words like UFO or stuff like that. It wasn't UFO anyway, it was landing. That's the other thing. It landed and it took off. I mean, oh my God, it was on the ground 45 minutes. And come on, there's a lot of stuff to this. And it was a mass sighting. I mean, I didn't see the landing, but, the guys working at Bentwaters, they seen the landing in the forest. They seen the bubble of light over it. They're telling me all this afterwards. I didn't see that. But it's a mass sighting. And there's civilians, too, that seen it. They're coming home from parties or whatever it was because it was around Christmas. I talked to some of those folks. But it definitely was a mass sighting. So I don't know how many. I could guess maybe, who knows, the amount of people have seen that. Because I just don't know the number for people who are off base in that. On base, it was probably around, anywhere from 60 to 100. I don't really know.
Any reason why Bentwaters? I was just doing stuff, and I don't know if you want to get into the nuke thing. I was just doing a thing with a B-52 coming into Minot in 1967. And the thing's on the ground, they tell it to do a flyby over top of it again. And then when they land, they find out that it took a cover off of one of the nukes, a 20-ton cover, and flipped it off onto the side. And you see all this stuff where they seem to, 1975, when Travis was taken, every night that Travis was taken, there was a UFO over a nuke at Malmstrom or at Loring. And so if you got any thoughts on why they're coming to Rendlesham or why they're interested in nukes?
Well, one is it's on the coordinates. I mean, that is done on the same level of the coordinates.
Yeah, that's right.
But the other thing is, I think 25 or 30 miles north, we have Sizewell, huge nuclear plant. I mean, it's one of the biggest in the UK. And then, you know, of course, we had the weapons in storage that were nuclear, but they were like for F-4s. They couldn't be used anyway, but they were there. A-10s don't carry nukes. They can't. They can't get away fast enough after they drop them. You know what I mean? You got to get the hell out of them. So, you know, yeah. So is there a nuclear factor? You know, I'm starting on the bona fide cases I know of, or the ones I believe in, because they have earmarks of Rendlesham in there. I would say that there is a high chance. I think confidence is high that nuclear weapons or nuclear fission material is a factor somehow. I think it's high confidence. You know, I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure. You know.
Beautiful. Mitzi, have you got any questions? People, there's lots of people I see posting questions. Have you got some you want to throw out?
Yeah, there's six different questions. The first one was 750, and it's by Susan. And I'm not sure how to say the name because it's Spanish. I want to know where and why the reference came in. Mention the NAZCA.
The Nazca line?
I didn't catch it.
The Nazca. I think they're talking about the Nazca site.
Yeah.
Nazca.
Nazca.
What's the question?
What was the question about it?
I can read it if you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to know where and why the reference came and mentioned to Nazca. I recognize that word as it is on my t-shirt that I bought in Peru, and it is shown as Calendario Nazca, along with the pictures of two different calendars. What is the meaning of Nazca, and why is it something you mentioned?
That's Gary, you'll have to answer that.
Yeah, it's a key location. It's one of the coordinates that were found in the code. And
really?
Yeah, it's one of the coordinates, and it's where all the petroglyphs are, you know, the lines that are kind of marked on the ground.
I was there on in a plane, and I could see all of them.
Yeah, they uncover, they make these lines by taking the topsoil, the darker topsoil off, and leaving the lighter colored soil underneath. Okay. And they create these petroglyphs, and some of them are ancient. Some are still being made, you know, and they're still finding petroglyphs that have been recently made. But yeah, one of the coordinates is the Nazca coordinates found in the code. And it's significant because of the distance from the Nazca coordinates to the Giza Plateau, which is exactly 7,687 miles, which is in the public domain. So whoever devised the code knew about this number, this distance, of 7,687 miles, which is already in the public domain by this guy named Stanley Mailer, a theorist. So that it would kind of, I don't know, so it would, the number distance, 7,687 miles, would prove that this was significant in the code, you know, because it's already in the public domain. What's happening right now is that I have all these things coming into my mind, but I don't really want to talk about it because it's going to make it too complicated. Okay. One of the reasons why I find this very difficult to explain, because I can see how it all connects together, but when I'm trying to unravel it to explain it to people, it's very difficult, and I get lost in the details.
Yes, I understand. So, I understand. Okay, thank you.
And but that is one of the things I think that we got to point out is it's not a simple thing. It's not landing on the White House lawn and reading a speech. It's very, very complex. And when you figure it out, you go, oh, because it just rings a bell. You realize there's no way this could be coincidence, all these numbers. And
yeah, I've always said
that's what they're making you do. They're making work of this.
Yeah, thing. I've always said, Grant, I'm a much better writer than I am at verbalizing this. You know, it's very difficult for me to explain it to people because it's all mathematical. I mean, people put a wall up against numbers and mathematics anyway, because we've all been intimidated at school through mathematics. You know, a lot of us hate math. So, you know, you people, you know, they got to get beyond that barrier to see, to look into this and see it for themselves, how extraordinary this is, how elegant it all connects together, you know?
Yes.
And that, yeah. And that's the thing. I even went to, I showed the Jimmy Blanchette material to Josephson, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics. And he said, well, I haven't got time to watch the video for 2 hours. And I said, okay. Then Jimmy gave me a 1 minute thing of the numbers and how they all fit together. And I went to him and I said, here's your 1 minute thing. And he said, oh, the guy sounds like he's crazy. And I said, well, that seems kind of strange, because that's what they said. You were crazy because you believed in telepathy. This guy went, and he just disappeared. And that's the thing, is a lot of people just don't want to go through the effort of, right. of the numbers. Because it is not that simple. It's not a simple speech that they're giving us, or a simple they're aliens from here or whatever.
Exactly.
It's much more complex than that.
Exactly. But you know what I did find with the code, right? What it is telling us is that reality itself is mathematical.
Yeah. There's relationships between everything and nature. Yeah.
Yeah. You've heard of ontological mathematics. I mean, it's been talked about in certain areas. And, well, you know, that's one of the things that I got from the code, that reality is mathematical. I mean, if you, the universe is mathematical. If you didn't have math in the universe, it would fall apart. If you didn't have mathematics in the universe, you didn't have numbers in the universe, it would just fall apart. It'd be chaos. So at the very base of reality is mathematics. And we are mathematical beings. And mathematics actually proves that we are immortal, because it's a mathematical certainty. You know, energy cannot be destroyed. It's mathematical. So, yeah, I've gone into all that as well. I've gone into all the ontological mathematics. And that's something that science, if science was to adopt ontological mathematics, instead of thinking that mathematics is just a human tool, it's a human invention, and it's just an abstract tool to work out certain things. If they was to actually, like, realize that reality itself is made of mathematics, then there would be a, paradigm shift.
And there's another question just came up, and it said, why the riddles? And I have a whole thing, I call it the theory of wow now. Like, why do you do a crop circle? Because everybody goes, what is that? I mean, you're sitting there and you can't let it go. You can't forget it. It's in your head, and it drives you nuts. If it wasn't weird, like if cattle mutilations weren't weird, nobody would pay any attention to them. They make it really weird because they want to get your attention. They want you to think about it. That's, to me, is the riddle part. And bravo to you guys to unravel this thing. I mean, it's just incredibly complex, and took you guys years to put this whole thing together.
Yeah, it's taken years to discover all these. Like, it's funny because it's like a grid of information. It's like a ball of information. It's like a grid network where one thing confirms something, and that in turn is confirmed by something else, and it all works together. It's all meticulous and precise. And when you're trying to communicate it to people, you have all these things coming into your mind that you want to say and you want to talk about, because one thing you're talking about will lead to something else and then something else. So you want to kind of, it's all kind of holistic, and you try to unravel it to try to communicate it to people. And it's very difficult, you know,
but it is important. I mean, you guys, this is an important story. I would say to everybody that if you understand what's going on here, this is like the key to reality. They're basically have unraveled this, and there's probably a lot of more you're going to discover yet that you haven't discovered yet from the same code.
Oh yeah, sure. Because every time I find something, and I'm even finding something now, it was only last week I found something that was really important. I sent it to Manu, and he said, yeah, that's even better than I thought. But it's like, I feel like someone's looking over my shoulder from the future each time I find something. Yes, that's right. That's why you've got to connect that to that. And, you know, it's kind of strange how all this is coming about, but it's an ongoing thing that will go into the future, you know? Yeah. So even when I pass, that I'm sure it's going to be passed on to someone who's going to take it further. It's just an ongoing thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Mitzi, next one.
Did you have a question? Mm. Okay. Professor Paul.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi there.
Hi.
How you doing?
Very good. Thanks. Yeah. And Gary and Grant, we met in the conference a few years ago before the plague. And anyways, you explained this again, the significance of this event, I think, is not only mathematical, but it's on a mythological level. It is a whole new worldview, and which has to do with this galactic harmonics and how this is connected with what Jimmy Blanchett is discovering, the sacred geometrics and the galactic harmonics. There's something that you have been gifted this experience. And so I really think your dreams and what is being manifested from the unconscious over the next few years will be very, very important. So I'm really thankful that you know, and Grant, I must say, I've never heard you say wow so many times in one interview with Jimmy Blanchett. But to have
it, even though I don't understand it, I realize it's significant. There's no way you could get the numbers that exact. It's like, wow.
I know, but it is poetry. It's galactic poetry. It's just really, really good. And to have Jim and Gary and Jimmy, I mean, to have a conversation with, I think that slowly pulls it together.
Yeah.
And I think they're different. We're connecting the dots on this. And it's, again, we've been gifted this. And I think you're absolutely right on. It's coming from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And so how this is manifested, I think, is going to be very important. And I think crop circles might be the key to it, because that manifests the imagery of sacred geometry. And core to all of this is the golden proportion, the golden ratio. And so if you look at some of the patterns that are coming out in the fields of Wiltshire and in America, you'll see how it manifests. And I think there might be a theme there that can help pull some of these different things together. But I, in terms of the coordinates, what Gary's done is just amazing, that the multi-level. Anyways, I just, this is really good. Thank you very much for and Mitzi and for hosting this. I think it's really, really significant.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
You had a question.
You have a question.
Mark, I already answered it.
Okay.
I was wondering, just from Jim's point of view, and I'm not sure if you've mentioned it already, but I'd like to ask it anyways. I hear that you don't sound like much of an experiencer because of how you sort of try to distance yourself after the fact. You know, most people live it, and like a guy like Grant has lived it for how many years, Grant? 40 some years. Although your story is incredibly important by the sounds of it, and the math that's coming from it, and the code seems to be connected to maybe this matrix that we live in. I guess, Jim, I'd like to ask you, have you ever had any other experiences? Like, was this the only experience you had in your life, and you've never experienced anything before or after this?
That's correct. I found the one time is enough. It was sufficient. You know, I don't need to have I don't want to have. I mean, I tell you what, the last 43 years, I could have done without all this stuff, believe me. It isn't living with you. It's living with you daily. Sometimes it's not as pronounced, but you know, it's terrible. I just wish it was somebody else that was out there. I wish I wasn't involved with it. I think that the way this stuff is all seems like it's by design. I think it could have been anybody out there, and they could have done just as good a job as I did, or probably better. Okay. I just don't think that.
You were just the one that carried the code, right?
It was just, the messengers, apparently. I mean, but and I think that with when we did the July 2019 MUFON out in Irvine, California, I think that's when I really realized, because I had the authentication of the book, because people are crying about that, and I had what is his name, Wood, he went and re-authenticated it and all that kind of stuff, and
Robert Yeah, Robert Wood.
Robert Wood, yeah. And when I was off there, I sort of realized that I guess I was just I just was hoping that one evening when I did the presentation, I didn't want to really be there. I hate that kind of stuff, to be honest with you. It's just I can talk in front of people, but I did that in the military. You know, you do a security threat brief and you got 500 people up. It's informative type stuff, but I don't really care for conferences, to be honest with you.
No, you're not the kind of person who wants to bring attention to yourself, are you, Jim?
I don't like it. And here I am. I know, here I am. That's the problem. I mean,
I think it's because you were down to earth.
What was that last question that came up?
About, they're talking about you're taking notes. They picked you because you could take notes.
Because I can take notes. I can, you know what, though? I made every one of my guys out there carry a notebook, and they had to take notes too. You know?
Yeah, I think it's because you're a no-nonsense, down-to-earth guy. That is one of the reasons why this happens to you. You in the USAF. You can't get more down-to-earth than that.
And you haven't been public. You haven't really lectured a lot.
No, I try not to. I will do a podcast or, even doing some of the documentaries. That's different. You're sitting down with four people. You know what I mean? It's easy stuff. It's not that I get nervous or anything. I'm not. That's the thing. I'm just giving a briefing. I'm giving an informative talk on what happened. I mean, it's pretty easy.
Someone apologize if you're going to have bad dreams tonight.
I probably will. I probably will. I hate to say that, but it's not your fault. It's just that I don't know. See, but it doesn't mean it's necessary. I could have a night with none. I can't explain the hows and whys with it, okay? I know it was brutal when I went over for the reunion in 2010, and being there, especially when you're there with some of the people that you're out there with originally, and, oh man, that was like brutal. But I think it's important that I tell what happened. Because there's been so much misinformation out there. That's disturbing. And I don't know why people do it. Why don't they just shut up? If they don't know what happened, just shut up. Okay, don't sit there and try to embellish. That's the other thing. They try to sensationalize something so sensational, I can't even describe it. I mean, why would you want to sensationalize that?
Those are the people that make the documentaries. The documentaries, they sensationalize it when the documentaries, didn't they?
Right.
You've been involved.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But didn't OSI do that as well? Of put different ideas in people's heads so that everybody's telling a different story? Did they do any of that?
Well, sort of. They did a containment story. I describe it in the book. And that went out to the pubs and that. And it was the one, your standard UFO alien whatever story, just another UFO story. And that was a story that Warren used to hoax his involvement. That's why Hulk got a hold of me after I retired in 93, that we wanted to do a documentary. And that wasn't the way for answers. I mean, they all had their own agenda. So I went over with Hall to England. We did a documentary over there. And that was interesting, too. It was Strange But True was the name of the documentary. And we sat down at the production meeting. And I had my notebook with me. And so we get all done with the storyboards and all that stuff. I'm like, this looks like it's going to suck. And so I get a hold of the producer afterwards. Hey, I says, why don't we concentrate on some of the stuff in the notebook, about my drawings and stuff. He looked at it and he goes, no, the storyboard's already done. He says, thank you anyway. I went, okay. And so I just never showed it again, It's crazy.
Yeah, Todd, all they were worried. first. He wasn't really interested because all he was a guy on set who was making sure everything ran properly. So he wasn't really interested in the incident.
That's right.
What do you do now, Jim? You've been retired a lot of years. How do you spend your days?
I have been traveling this summer, you know, coming up. I have a cabin I go to up in northeastern Iowa on the Mississippi up there. And I do spend some time up there. And I've been going to reunions in the military. I got people all over the world, the United States, man. So I drive into those reunions. And I got two scheduled this year. One of them was with the SAC Elite Guard in Omaha, that one there. That one's going to be in Dayton, by the way. And I got another one at Ellsworth Air Force Base coming up in September. I'll be going to that. I do write when I feel like it. I do write down. I have probably a half a book written, if you put it in a book. I probably got about 150 pages written. But I only, once in a while, I'll write it, and not often, because I don't think the world's ready for that one.
So, when you go to these reunions, and they really don't have anything to do with UFOs, but do they identify you as, hey, is that UFO guy here? I heard that UFO guy's here. I want to talk to him. Do you get people who come to you that have heard the story that they want to hear it from the horse's mouth?
Well, yeah, we're in contact, you know, on the internet, you know, through Facebook and stuff like that. Yeah, they already know that. I mean, you know, all of them bought books. But I'll tell you what, when I was writing this with Gary, I was in contact with a lot of these people at different bases. They'll get a hold of me and say, hey, do you want your name in there? You know, I'll tell something about that. And they go, no. No, that's okay. They didn't want their name in there. I mean, I can understand it, I guess. I mean, all the problems with people pointing their fingers at you. That I just don't give a shit. I don't care anymore. Yeah, if you don't believe me, don't believe me. If you want to point your finger at me, point your finger at me. I don't care.
It doesn't matter. A lot of the researchers and the investigators of the RFI, the Rendlesham incident, they've kind of cancelled our book, haven't they? They don't ever talk about it. They won't mention it.
It's over their head.
And if there's anyone, any of the witnesses are going to be kind of, I don't know, discredited, it will always be you. You know, they try to discredit other than the other witnesses.
They'll try to. You know what? Here we are, 43 years later. Go ahead and debunk RFI. Go ahead and debunk me. Go ahead and do all
that. I wonder why there's an agenda to do that. You know, why there's an agenda. Maybe it's because of the code. Maybe the code is like something that they can't really.
No, it doesn't fit their agenda, Gary. That's why.
Yeah, that's right. Because we don't say it's alien. Because you've always said that the craft that you encountered was an unidentified triangle craft of unknown origin. That's all you could say. You couldn't say it was alien. And even with the code,
well,
you know,
most people can't. I don't know. People see stuff in the sky, they say, oh, that's alien. No, they don't know that. They're making it up.
It goes against the popular narrative that this is alien and extraterrestrial, this phenomenon, you know.
Here's the name of the book. We were just asked that. Here's the name of the book, The Rendlesham Enigma.
Yeah.
It is available on Amazon.com.
Yeah.
It's huge.
You know what? The reason why it's huge, you know, the reason why there's so many endnotes, because I was so interested in the JFK assassination and reading books on that and other periods in history. James DiEugenio, who wrote one of the books about the JFK assassination, he did such a scholarly work on it and all these endnotes. And I thought, you know, the only way I can really tell this is through a book where you have, like, part of the book is your account, Jim, you know, what you experienced and the aftermath. And the other part is all what happened around you, things that you weren't even aware of, and what other witnesses were saying, what other people had found and what they discovered and the certain events that were happening. So I thought it had to be two books, really. Because the books that have come out about the Rendlesham incident before, it was kind of all mixed up and you didn't know where you were with it. And I wanted to make sure it was chronological as well. It had a chronological timeline to it. That's the reason why the book is called Timeline. So, and I've really got that from reading books about the JFK assassination and how those books were showing all these events, what happened in a chronological manner, you know. So that was kind of the inspiration for me writing the book the way it is. Yeah.
That took you a long time to... Oh, go ahead.
No, I appreciate the way you wrote the book, because a lot of people are just telling stories. It's almost like Walker said, you're just curious. Admit it. You just want a story. That's all you're interested in. And and you're more into what I'm into is like, what does this mean? Like what's the bottom line to this thing? And that's where you start, when you start seeing the mathematics and how it all fits together. Then you go like, oh, that's what UFOs may be about. These guys may have got the key to the whole thing, and the rest of it is all just stories that they make you happy and you can make money from them, but they don't really mean anything, just a story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, like Gary, what I liked about him from the start is he was a skeptic. He was a skeptic.
I'm still am skeptical about a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really agree with a lot of the New Age stuff, even though I've kind of written in that genre. I mathematics to me is now the thing that proves things, you know. That's why I'm so into the mathematics. That's in my, what they call it, your wheelhouse. That's in my wheelhouse. Yeah. Mathematics, proving things through mathematics, you know, because everything else is subjective, you know. So... yeah, which is the reason why, Grant, I am interested in the UFO phenomenon, but I get weary of it, you know, because you can't really prove anything. A lot of it is anecdotal. And for me, the code is what is proving something, you know?
Yeah. Like, I've been at it for 48 years, and people always say, do you want to go skywatch? And I go, I saw something. I saw something pretty close, 75. I really don't want to see anything. I've seen something. I want to figure out what the hell is going on here. I'm not interested in a show and circus anymore. I'm more interested in sort of what you guys have got, is that you go, oh, that's what's going on when you see it. And it makes sense. It's complex, but it sort of gives a something that it is more tangible in terms of what might actually be going on. And that's why I think your story is so important.
I'm glad you said that. As I said, that's one of the reasons why I think that you're one of the most respected UFO.
Right. So, I agree.
To me, I mean, you're right up there, top drawer.
I mean, and you know, Grant, I think, didn't you interview Masters?
Michael Masters.
Didn't you interview him?
I don't think so.
You need to interview him.
He's got a new book out called The Extratempestrial Hypothesis. Yeah.
Wow.
He's a professor from Montana. He's archaeology or something like that. I don't know what he does. And he's written some really good books on this, and he's been in the middle of writing another.
Didn't he, Jim? He mentions the binary code, the Rendlesham binary code in his book.
He does. Yes.
I think the world is sort of changing in terms of ufology. Most people are, you know, not most, but some people are realizing this is more complex than extraterrestrials. It may not be extraterrestrial. There's something bigger going on here. And so I think more people are moving. Yeah. It's almost like Max Planck says, you don't convince your opponent you're right by convincing, you know, you don't change your opponent by convincing him you're right. It moves one funeral at a time. And so it's not like we're going to convert everybody. It's just slowly drip by drip by drip. You guys put in a piece and you know, another piece goes in, Gary puts in another piece. And it's just slowly coming more to, I think, the worldview, especially when I saw Jimmy Blanchett's stuff. As soon as I saw his stuff, I said, oh, you got to get in contact with the Rendlesham guys. Like it was just like, they're all talking singing from the same song sheet, a little bit different in terms of what mathematics are looking at. But you realize, people are starting to figure this thing out.
I'm glad. I'm pleased you gave me that connection with Jimmy Blanchett, Grant. I'm really pleased about that.
And Jimmy, for people who don't know, is a guy from Canada who had just sort of a triangle sighting, and he started doing mathematics, and he looked at it, and he started to get this idea maybe he could communicate, and it just sort of one piece after another piece, and he realized this was related to that, and this was related to that. And if you look at it, it's very, very complex like this in terms of stuff. But it's when you take a look at it, there's absolutely no way this is coincidence, all these numbers and how everything fits together. And it links up with what you guys are doing. And it's almost like the time is right when this is going to come. And I'm glad I got to see it. I mean, because I've been done it for so many years, and for the first 40 years, I mean, I was just tracking stories like everybody else. It wasn't until, the last couple of years where I think I've started to figure out what's maybe really going on here.
Yeah.
Well, I knew you had it. You figured it out in 2019 when I was talking to you. I knew it then. Okay, Grant. I said, oh, I think Grant has this figured out. So,
Yeah. I mean, when we're talking about, Jim, when we talk about extra temporal, you know, this being it, that kind of the nature of it being what
might be. Well, the causality
you know,
part?
Time related. I mean, you're really talking about something that's interdimensional as well. If you're talking about time, right. Talking about something that's interdimensional. You know, and I remember Professor Jean Paul, who was on just now. I mean, he says to me that this is more aligned. This phenomenon is more aligned with our spiritual side.
There is a side to that spiritual part to this, and I just can't really describe it. I did a podcast a week or two ago from Australia, and that was part of it. And I tried to describe it to this host. I said, there is a degree of it being some spiritual. I just can't describe what it is. I said, I can't put my finger on it. And and also, this is also that part of a little bit of consciousness. I mean, it's sort of tied in there, but the other factor is I'm sure that advanced humans at this point, my guess is that they're going to be AI, it's going to be AI type related stuff.
Oh yeah, because mm-hmm. we know from the way technology is advancing, you know, with nanotechnology, you know, quantum computing, and where you know things are going in the direction that we become. Well, what Jack Sefardi said, you know. Post-human AI hybrids, you know, that in the future will be part machine, part consciousness. And that's what could happen, that in the future, using quantum computers and all this technology, that they'd be able to break the time barrier and send in information back. So, you know, that seems viable to me because even more than the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that it's always been us. You know, that it's either our spiritual side or something in the future where we become, you know, the technology allows us to be able to break certain barriers.
Any other questions people have? They can just open up the audio.
Carol. Carol goes next.
Okay.
Carol?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Grant. Thank you, Mitzi, and also Jim and Gary. My question is, I've been listening to the content in here and sort of put these topics together. Whatever it is, are humans supposed to go up into higher levels of consciousness, Jim, so that we can, I've heard about, you know, controlling UFOs with our minds or you know, changing the DNA, going through vortices.
I'll tell you right now, we can't control nothing. Okay, zero.
Nothing. Yeah, right now.
They let us control. They control. If they want you to remember the sighting, if they want you to remember them, one of the theories I do have. You know, and I don't throw out the stuff where people say they see grays and stuff like that. Well, I am convinced from Rendlesham that this temporal travel, this interdimensional travel, it's just too hard for corporeal life. Okay. So I think that maybe there's a possibility that they develop some type of hybrid AI type creature. You know, to be able to do that. And I says, maybe that's what the grays are. I don't know. You know, I says,
biological possibility. Kind of AI entity.
That's right. And I don't discount everything. One of the things I do discount is the alien theory that they're visiting Earth. No. Do I think there's life in the universe? Absolutely, there's got to be. I just don't believe they're visiting Earth. I believe this has been the phenomena that we've been seeing for on Earth here for the last 5,000 years. You know, is nothing more than humans that have reached the level of do interdimensional travel. That's probably going to be the only way that they can probably go to other places too. Who knows? You know, but I don't know. Consciousness. I think we're developing. I think that we are evolving, and who knows how we're going to be in the future. I think just the last 25 years is really a little bit shocking for me as far as this to see how looking at your grandkids or anything like that, how they're evolving. I mean, I was on Easter, I was over and I'm looking at my, this is true. I'm looking at a 2.5-year-old girl and she's got herself an iPad. And I'm like, God, I couldn't handle anything close to that. At 6 years old, I was still probably making my own toys or something, or in the shop or something. I mean, I could, the advancement is just incredible. So it's incredible. I don't know.
One of the things that have come out of the code.
More questions, and we'll have.
One of the things that have come out of the code is this theme of balance. Yeah. And the Star Trek series, the political system in Star Trek is a meritocracy. And I think that what's happening is we're not going to be able to send to the stars or break this time barrier thing that we think is what this is operating from until we become a meritocracy, where people are empowered because of they have merit, because they're intelligent, they're intellectual, virtuous. And once we have that system in place, then I think that all things will start to open up for us. But at the moment, we are like children, and it's not going to happen until we install a meritocratic system. That's one of the themes that come out of code. Has anyone got anything to say about that?
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
I have a question. I had mine in the chat, but I thought I'd share since I'm already talking. Thanks to great speech, you guys, and great sharing of the experience. I came across you, Jim, before on YouTube, hearing your story years ago. I never thought I'd hear you actually speak. My question is... So I've Googled a little bit about High Brazil before, but is there any new information that anybody knows about what is supposedly there or why it could be so important, if that makes sense? So that's my question in short.
Well, I know that Gary's got image of from a satellite that shows clearly that there's an island that's submerged. I mean, right, you still have that photograph, right?
Yeah, the heat photography that shows that photography that shows there's something in that region. Yeah, under the
surface. Yeah, of all the coordinates, that's the one that's written down twice, High Brazil, and that's the one, and then it's underneath the water, and I'm like, that's the one that always perplexed me the most. I mean, all the rest of them have. Pyramids of some sort there. Even the one over in Sedona, if you're up from a satellite type view, you can see the pyramid. And you can see one like at the Nazca, the same thing. Gary found another pyramid that was there. So they're all related, but the thing that with High Brazil, whoever gave us the message thought it was important enough to list that twice. Why? I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that.
talks of origin as well. It's in the code. It's saying it's on the origin, and it's, they give the year, what I think is the year 8100, and that's possibly from the future. Maybe that region, that island, may become significant in the future. It will rise again.
It could be that. Maybe the water level dropped 90 feet or raised, or who knows?
Yeah.
Well, I would ask Jim and Gary to come back again.
Yes.
So, Mark, do you have any last minute things to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to add to thank also, you know, the guests for coming in today and providing their time and their knowledge of what their experiences have been. Also, I'd like to recognize Mitzi, who's going away for a couple of months, and she is going to hopefully have a fantastic getaway and a holiday. I thank Betty, and I also really, Laura, these are people that make this thing happen. And, you know, Grant for coming in and doing it, who started this group. It's been, you know, quite a journey so far. And this is just another one of those journeys that leads you to all kinds of places that keeps you asking more questions. So I appreciate you all, and I thank you for all for coming. It was a well-attended night.
Thank you.
A special guest for next month, Mark, too? Yes.
Kay Randall May is on next month. And I have to tell you, I met her in Phoenix a couple of weeks ago and had a discussion for a couple hours about her experiences, and they are quite remarkable.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.